Indeed, observe your calling, brothers, that not many intelligent men, not many powerful, not many of noble birth are chosen, but God chose the foolish things of the world, so he might embarrass those who are wise. He has said that the foolishness of God is wiser than men. He has shown that human wisdom is dismissed, both by the evidence of the Scriptures and by the outcome of events, by the evidence where he exclaims, "I will destroy the wisdom of the wise," by the outcome, posing his argument as a question and asking, "Where is the wise? Where is the scribe?" Again, he evidenced simultaneously that the thing is not new but ancient, as it was indicated and predicted from the beginning. For it is written, he says, "I will destroy the wisdom of the wise." He further demonstrates that it was neither inappropriate nor unjustifiable for things to take this course, and that the cross is an exhibition of immeasurable power and wisdom, and that the foolishness of God is significantly superior to the wisdom of man. And this, too, he proves not through the instructors, but via the students themselves. For, "Behold your calling," he says, that not only untrained teachers, but students of the same level were his selections, that he chose not many wise men, according to the flesh. Thus that of which he is talking is proven to surpass both in might and wisdom, in that it persuades both the many and the unwise, it being extraordinarily challenging to convince an ignorant individual, especially when the discourse involves significant and necessary matters. However, they did bring conviction. And of this he summons the Corinthians themselves as witnesses. "For behold your calling, brethren," he says, "contemplate, scrutinize. For such wise teachings, indeed wiser than all, to be accepted by ordinary men, signals the highest wisdom in the teacher. Not many powerful, not many high-ranking, for these, too, are filled with pride. And nothing is as unhelpful in truly understanding God as being arrogant and being anchored to wealth, for these cause a person to admire the present things and ignore the future, and they block the ears due to the numerous worries. But the foolish things of the world God chose, which is the greatest sign of victory, that those who were uneducated are the ones by whom he conquers. For the Greeks do not feel so much embarrassment when they are defeated by the wise, but are then bewildered when they observe the craftsman and the kind of person one encounters in the market to be more philosophical than themselves. This is why he said himself, that he might embarrass the wise. And not only in this instance has he done this, but also with the other benefits of life. For, to continue, the weak things of the world he chose, that he might embarrass the strong. For not just unlearned persons, but also the needy, and despised and unknown, he called, to lower those who were in high places. But what is meant by according to the flesh? It refers to what one can see in relation to the current life, according to the teachings of the non-Jews. However, he doesn't contradict himself. He stated not, "no wise men," but "not many wise men." For he didn't intentionally call the ignorant while ignoring the wise, but he accepted the wise as well, but the uneducated in larger numbers. And why is that? Because the individual who is worldly wise is often filled with profound foolishness. This person perfectly fits the term foolish, especially when he refuses to abandon his flawed beliefs. It's like a doctor willing to share the secrets of his profession with certain individuals, those who already know a bit, but practice in a wrongful and stubborn way might not be receptive to learning, but those who know nothing would have a greater willingness and openness to receiving new information. Thus the uneducated were more open to being convinced, as they were free from the severe delusion of considering themselves wise. In fact, the height of foolishness lies in these individuals, those who rely on reason to comprehend matters that can only be understood by faith. For instance, if a blacksmith pulls out a hot iron from a fire using tongs, and someone insists on doing it barehanded, we would undoubtedly consider him an absolute fool. Similarly, those philosophers who insisted on discovering these divine truths themselves undervalued faith, and it's due to this attitude that they failed to find the truths they were seeking for. V. 28. And the ordinary things of the world, and the things that are disdained, and the things that are ignored, that he might nullify the things that exist. Now, what does he refer to as things that do not exist? Those people who are seen as nothing due to their immense insignificance. In this way, he has demonstrated his great power, taking down the eminent through those who appear to be nothing. This is also expressed in, "For my strength is perfected in weakness." For it is indeed powerful to educate outcasts and those who never committed themselves to any form of learning on how to suddenly speak wisely about celestial matters. For example, consider a doctor, a speaker, or anyone else. We admire them the most when they convince and educate those who are completely uneducated. Now, if imbibing an uneducated person with the principles of any discipline is extraordinary, then much more so are matters which pertain to profound philosophy. But not only for the sake of wonders, nor to display his own power, has he done this, but also to curb the arrogant. Hence, he previously stated, to confound the wise and the strong, to bring the things that are to nothing, and repeats it here again, V29. That no one should boast in the presence of God, for God does everything to this end, to suppress arrogance and pride, to pull down boasting. You too, he says, should engage in that task. He does everything, so that we may not credit anything to ourselves, that we may attribute all unto God. And have you surrendered yourselves to this person or to that? And what forgiveness will you gain? For God himself has shown that it's not possible for us to be saved solely by ourselves. And this he demonstrated from the start. For neither then could people be saved by themselves. But it required appreciating the beauty of the heaven, the extent of the earth, and everything else in creation, if they might be guided to the great Creator of all works. And he did this, repressing in advance the self-conceit that was later to arise. Just as a teacher tells his student to follow him wherever he might lead, observes him jumping ahead, trying to learn everything on his own, lets him stray, and when proving him incapable of acquiring knowledge, finally introduces what he has to teach. So God also instructed at the start to trace him through the concept creation gives, but since they wouldn't, he, after proving through trials that they can't take care of themselves, guides them back to him in another way. He provided the world as a study tool, but the philosophers didn't learn from these things, weren't willing to obey him, or to approach him through the way he commanded. He introduces another route more evident than the former, one that could convince that man is not self-sufficient. For then complex reasoning and worldly wisdom might be used on the part of those whom he was guiding through creation. But now, unless a man becomes a fool, that is, unless he dismisses all reasoning and wisdom, and surrenders himself to the faith, it's impossible to be saved. You see that besides simplifying the way, he has thereby eradicated a serious ailment, namely forbidding boasting and arrogance. So no one could boast. Indeed, sin stems from the fact that people insist on being wiser than God's laws, not willing to gain knowledge the way he had indicated, and thus they didn't gain it at all. It was the same from the start. He told Adam, "Do this and don't do that." Adam, as if thinking to figure out something more, disobeyed, and even lost what he had. He told those that followed, "Don't settle on the created, but through it contemplate the Creator." They, presumably thinking they had devised something wiser than what had been commanded, launched several convoluted theories. Hence they continually conflicted with themselves and each other, and neither found God nor had any precise knowledge about creation, nor had any appropriate and accurate opinion about it. Therefore, again, decisively lowering their conceit, he admitted the uneducated first, showing that all people need wisdom from above, and not only in the matter of knowledge, but also in all other concerns, he constituted both people and all other creatures to be greatly dependent on him, so they might also have this as a strong motive for submission and attachment, lest turning away they should perish. For this reason, he didn't allow them to be self-sufficient. For even now, many, despite their neediness, despise him. If that weren't the case, where would they not have gone astray in their arrogance? So, he prevented them from boasting, not out of resentment, but to steer them away from the ensuing destruction. But what does "of God" mean? Whenever he mentions significant things about the only begotten, he adds mention of the Father, so that no one should think that the Son is unbegotten. Since, therefore, he had declared his power to be so great, and had attributed everything to the Son, stating that he had become wisdom unto us, and righteousness, and sanctification, and redemption, he again attributes everything to the Father through the Son, he says, of God. But why didn't he say, He has made us wise, but rather, was made unto us wisdom? This is to illustrate the abundance of the gift. It's as if he said, He gave us himself. And notice the sequence of his statements. For first, he made us wise by freeing us from error, and then righteous and holy by giving us the Spirit. And he has so rescued us from all our problems to the point of being of him, not representing shared existence, but referring to faith. In other places, we find him saying, We were made righteous in him. In these phrases, Him who knew no sin he made to be sin for us, that we might be made the righteousness of God in him. But now he says, He has been made righteousness unto us, allowing anyone who wishes to partake abundantly. For it isn't this person or that who has made us wise, but Christ. Let anyone who boasts, therefore, boast in him, not in one person or another. All things have come from Christ. Thus, having said, Who was made unto us wisdom and righteousness and sanctification and redemption, he added, So that, as it is written, anyone who boasts, let them boast in the Lord. V30. But it is because of him that you are in Christ Jesus, who has become for us wisdom from God, and righteousness and sanctification and redemption. For this reason, he had strongly criticized the wisdom of the Greeks, to teach men this lesson and no other, that they should take pride in the Lord. For when we seek the things above us by ourselves, nothing is more foolish, nothing weaker than ourselves. In such a case, we may have an eloquent tongue, but we cannot have stable doctrine. Rather, solitary reasoning is like a spider's web. For some have gone to the point of madness to claim that there is nothing real in all of existence. Indeed, they insist that all things are contrary to how they appear. The phrase, of him, I assume, is used here, not with reference to our creation, but with respect to our faith. More specifically, our transformation into children of God, not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh. Don't presume that after he removed our boasting, he left us just like that. There is another, a greater boasting, which is his gift. For you are the children of him before whom boasting is not suitable, becoming such through Christ. And since he stated, He chose the foolish things of the world and the base, he implies that they are the most noble, with God as their Father. And this nobility of ours is not due to any individual, but is a result of Christ, who made us wise, righteous, and holy. This is what the words, He was made unto us wisdom, imply. Do not therefore claim that anything is from you, but instead glory in God in all things. Do not attribute anything to anyone at any time, for if nothing should be attributed to Paul, even less should it be attributed to others. For he says, I planted, Apollos watered, but God provided the increase. Whoever has learned to boast in the Lord will never be proud, but will always be humble and appreciative, no matter the situation. But this is not the mindset of the Greeks. They attribute everything to themselves, which is why they even make gods out of men. This extreme arrogance has led them to such great shame. Who then is wiser than us who do not have the wisdom of Plato, but Christ himself, God having so decided? Then it's time now to wage war against these issues. Remember where we ended our discussion last time. We claimed that, logically speaking, it was impossible for fishermen to surpass philosophers, but yet it became possible, making it clear that it was made possible through grace. We argued that these fishermen couldn't even conceive such significant feats, and we proved not only did they conceive them, but they also accomplished them with remarkable ease. Let's revisit the same point in our argument today. Where did they get the idea to overcome the world unless they had seen Christ after his resurrection? Were they out of their minds to plan such a thing carelessly and haphazardly? Because without divine grace, success in such a grand undertaking surpasses all insanity. How did they achieve it if they were mad and delirious? But if they were sane, as indeed events proved, how could they commit to such great wars, take risks against earth and sea, and stand fearless and undeterred, seeking to change long-standing customs of the entire world, being just 12 men, without receiving trustworthy signals from heaven and the influence from above? And what's more, what made them think they could persuade their audience by promising them heaven and places above? Even if they had been brought up in honor, wealth, power, and education, it still wouldn't have been likely that they could inspire someone to take on such a challenging task. However, under those circumstances, their expectations might have been somewhat more reasonable. But as it was, Some of them had been working around lakes, some with hides, some with custom duties, jobs that couldn't be further from philosophy and persuading people to aim high, especially without any examples to show. In fact, they not only didn't have any examples of success to point to, but they had examples of failure right at their doorstep. For many who tried to bring about changes had been completely annihilated, and I'm not just talking about the Greeks, although that was significant, but among the Jews themselves at that very time, who had not just 12 men, but many more working towards their cause. Both Theudas and Judas had large groups of followers, but they perished along with their disciples. The fear from their examples should have served as a deterrent if they hadn't been so firmly convinced that achieving victory without divine power was impossible. Or, from another perspective, if they had felt this intense zeal while Christ was alive, they would have let it fade away after his death. For he would have appeared to them as a deceiver and impostor had he not risen. Don't you know that armies, while the general and king are alive, stay united even if they are weak? But when those in such positions have passed away, however strong they may be, they disband. Yes, even if they did anticipate success, what kind of hopes must they have held to embark on such great risks unless their sights were set on the world to come? But let's assume that they aspired for nothing less than victory. What did they expect to gain by persuading all people to follow him who has not risen again, as you say? For if now, people who believe in the kingdom of heaven and countless blessings reluctantly face dangers, how could they have endured so many for nothing, even more so for evil? For if what was done did not actually happen, if Christ did not ascend to heaven, surely in their persistent zeal to fabricate these things and convince the entire world of them, they were displeasing God and must expect a multitude of divine retributions from above. So tell me, what were the persuasive arguments they based their actions on when they were about to embrace the gospel and spread it throughout the world? Was there anything lacking to restrain them? If they had been insane, they wouldn't have succeeded at all, for no one takes the advice of the insane. But if they succeeded as in truth they did succeed, and the outcome proves it, then no one was as wise as they were. Now, if no one was as wise as they, it's clear they wouldn't have lightly embarked on the preaching. If they had not seen him after his resurrection, what would have been enough to make them go into this war? What wouldn't have deterred them from it? He told them, "After 3 days I will rise again," and he made promises about the kingdom of heaven. He said they would conquer the entire world after they had received the Holy Spirit and many other things beyond these, exceeding all nature. So if none of these things had happened, even though they believed in him while he was alive, after his death they wouldn't have believed in him unless they had seen him after his resurrection. For they have said, "After 3 days," he said, "I will rise again," and he has not risen. He promised that he would send the Spirit, and he has not sent him. How then can his sayings about the other world be credible to us, when his sayings about this one are tested and found lacking? But if you're still not convinced, consider this fact. If this wasn't the truth, even though they were well-intentioned, they wouldn't have preached this gospel in his name. They would have rejected him. You know that we don't like to even hear the names of those who deceive us. So why did they preach his name? Did they expect to gain power through him? In fact, the opposite would have been expected, that even if they were close to succeeding, they were destroying themselves by promoting the name of a deceiver. And if they wanted to undermine past events, the best course would have been to remain silent. Arguing vehemently about them would only provoke more hostility and ridicule. So where did they get the idea to create such stories? I say create, because they had forgotten what they had heard. And if during a time without fear, they forgot many things and some even failed to understand, then it stands to reason that during their moment of great fear, everything would have slipped from their minds. Why am I talking about words? Their love for their master himself began to gradually fade away due to the fear of impending events, a fact he reproached them for. Previously, they were inseparable from him, constantly asking, "Where are you going?" But later, when he began to speak at length about the fearsome events that would occur at and after his crucifixion, they remained silent and immobilized by fear. Listen to how he pointed this out to them, saying, "None of you are asking me, 'Where are you going?' Because I have told you these things, your hearts are filled with sadness. Now, if the anticipation of his death and resurrection brought them such sorrow, having failed to see him after he rose would have been devastating to them. They would have wanted to bury themselves in the earth due to the dejection of having been so deceived and the fear of what was to come, feeling themselves tightly cornered. And why, if he did not rise again, did they preach that he had risen? Because they loved him, you might argue, but surely it would be likely that they would despise him afterwards for tricking and betraying them, and because, having filled them with countless hopes and separated them from their homes, parents, and everything else, and created a hostility between them and the entire Jewish nation, he had deceived them in the end. And if the matter was due to weakness, they might have excused it. But now it would be perceived as a result of severe wickedness. For he should have told the truth, and not have promised heaven, being a mere mortal man, as you claim. So it would have been more probable for them to take a different approach, to expose the deception and declare him a fraud and impostor. In doing so, they could have escaped from all their dangers. They could have ended the war. Also, considering that the Jews offered money to the soldiers to claim they stole the body, if the disciples had stepped forward and admitted, 'We stole him, he has not risen,' what honor would they not have received? Thus, it was within their power to be celebrated, even crowned. So why then did they exchange these prospects for insults and dangers, if it was not some divine power that influenced them and proved stronger than all these? Again, where did their grand teachings come from? As for the deeper aspects, he said they will find out later. As he stated, 'I have so much more to tell you, but you are not ready to handle it now,' meaning that the unspoken teachings were complex. One of the disciples even hesitated to join him in Judea when he learned of potential threats and instead said, 'We should also go so we can die with him.' The disciple had a hard time coping due to the fear of anticipated death. If that disciple, while still in his company, was afraid of dying and recoiled due to that fear, what fears must he not have had later on, when separated from him and the other disciples, and when their shameless acts were fully exposed? Moreover, what did they have to convey when they ventured out? The crucifixion was indeed widely known, for he had been hung high upon the wooden frame, and during the day in a major city, during a significant feast from which attendance was practically obligatory. However, the resurrection was unseen by those outside their group. This understandably added to the difficulty of convincing others. Additionally, his burial was a topic of discussion for everyone. Both the soldiers and all the Jews claimed that his disciples had stolen his body, yet no outsiders had visual confirmation of his resurrection. On what basis, then, did they hope to convince the world? For if soldiers could be persuaded to state otherwise while miracles were occurring, how could these disciples expect to spread their message, let alone convince the world about the resurrection, without miracles and without any money? Furthermore, if they were motivated by the desire for glory, it would be more likely that they would have attributed teachings to themselves rather than the deceased. Could it be argued that people wouldn't have believed them? And which of the two scenarios would have been more likely to be accepted and believed when preached, he who was arrested and crucified, or these disciples who had evaded the Jews? But did the laws of the Romans aid them? No, by these laws they found themselves in even greater difficulties, for it was stated, 'Any man who proclaims himself a king is no friend of Caesar.' This alone was a significant hurdle for them, as they were initially followers of the one who was considered a usurper and later sought to fortify his cause. What on earth then pushed them to take such daunting risks? And what claims about him would make them believable? That he was crucified? That he was born of a poor Jewish woman who was engaged to a Jewish carpenter? That he was of a nation the world despised? No, all these things were not just enough to dissuade or entice the listeners, but also to repel everyone, especially when claimed by a tentmaker and a fisherman. Surely the disciples would remember all these obstacles. A fearful disposition tends to exaggerate reality, and that was their reality. On what basis then did they aspire to succeed? In fact, they had no such aspirations, with countless deterrents if Jesus had not truly risen. Isn't it clear even to the most casual observers that unless the disciples had been blessed with abundant and powerful grace and had received assurance of the resurrection, they would have been unable to pursue such extraordinary endeavors, let alone conceive them? For if they both conceived and executed plans that exceeded every expectation in the face of such enormous impediments, should we not assume that they accomplished these feats not through human strength but divine grace? Next, let me ask, what purpose did they have in following such a path? They didn't immediately leave Judea and enter the cities of the Gentiles, but traveled within its boundaries. But how did they convince without performing miracles? For if they truly performed them, it was the result of God's power. However, if they performed no miracles and still prevailed, the event was even more extraordinary. Did they not know the Jews? Tell me. And their malicious habits, and their hearts full of bitterness? For they even stoned Moses after crossing the sea by foot, after the victory and the miraculous triumph they achieved without bloodshed, through his hands over the Egyptians who held them in bondage, after the manna, after the rocks and the springs that gushed forth from them, after countless miracles in Egypt, at the Red Sea and in the wilderness. They cast Jeremiah into a pit and slew many prophets. Listen, for instance, to what Elijah says after the terrible famine, the amazing rainfall, the fire he called down from heaven, and the unusual burnt offering. He was driven to the very ends of their land. Lord, they have killed your prophets, they have demolished your altars, and I am the only one left, and they are seeking my life. However, those who were persecuted in this way were not disturbing any rules. So tell me then, why would people pay attention to these men we're speaking of? For on one hand, they were less important than any of the prophets. On the other, they were introducing radical new ideas which led the Jews to crucify even their master. We should practice these arguments, not on our own, but with each other. This way, the discovery of what remains will be easier for us. And in another way, it seemed less inexplicable for Christ to say such things than for them. For he, they might assume, acted this way to gain glory for himself. But these they would have disliked even more as they waged war with them on behalf of another. And don't, just because you're a tradesman, think that this type of exercise is outside of your role, for even Paul was a tent maker. Yes, says someone, but at that time he was also filled with abundant grace, and from that he spoke all things. Fair enough, but before this grace he was at the feet of Gamaliel. Moreover, he received the grace because he showed a mind worthy of the grace. And after these things he again resumed his craft. Therefore, let no one of those who have trades feel ashamed. Instead, those who do nothing and are idle, who employ many servants and are served by a large retinue, should. Because to be sustained by continuous hard work is a form of asceticism. The souls of such men are clearer and their minds better focused. For the one who has nothing to do is apt to say and do many things without purpose. He is busy all day long about nothing, a heavy lethargy consuming him entirely. But he who works will not lightly entertain any useless thing in deeds, words, or thoughts, as his whole soul is entirely focused on his labor-intensive livelihood. So let us not look down on those who support themselves from their own handiwork. Instead, we ought to consider them as fortunate. Because tell me, what gratitude are you owed when, after having received your portion from your father, you do nothing related to a skill, but are wastefully spending all of it randomly? Don't you know that we won't all have to answer the same account, but those who have wasted much here will face a stricter one, while those who labored or faced poverty or something similar won't be as severe? This is clear from the example of Lazarus and the rich man. You are fairly accused of neglecting the right use of free time, but the poor man, who has spent his remaining time on right objectives despite having a full workload, will receive great rewards. But do you claim that military duties should excuse you and blame them for your lack of free time? This excuse is unreasonable. Cornelius was a centurion, yet his military duty did not hinder his strict way of life. But you, when you are celebrating with dancers and actors, and completely wasting your life on entertainment, never think of using military service or fear of rulers to get out of these activities. But when we summon you to the church, then there are always endless obstacles. And what will you say on the day when you see the flame and the rivers of fire and the unbreakable chains and hear the gnashing of teeth? Who will stand up for you on that day when you see the one who has worked with their own hands and lived uprightly, enjoying all glory, but yourself, who are now in soft clothing and smelling of perfumes, in incurable woe? What good will your wealth and surplus do you? And the craftsman, what harm will his poverty do him? So to avoid suffering later, we should heed current warnings and devote our time to truly essential matters. By doing so, having earned God's forgiveness for our past sins and committing good deeds for the future, we will be able to reach the kingdom of heaven through the favor and love, etc., etc.